Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 832. What do you got on the corkboard, Katie Levine?
I got one that I think listeners of this podcast will really like. If you're interested in getting into comics as a professional writer or artist and you want to get information on self-publishing as well as hearing about the pitfalls you should avoid, then attend comics writer and editor Jim Higgins' one-day Getting Into Comics workshops on Sunday, October 23rd. That's this Sunday, from 11 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. at the Society of Illustrators in Eagle Rock. So if you're in L.A. and you're interested in comics, this sounds right up your alley. He'll give you an overview of the comics industry, inside info about submitting, what editors look for, and a lot of concrete resources and facts about self-publishing and Kickstarter. The cost of the class is $65. And if you don't know Jim, he's a comics writer and editor for 22 years. He's worked at DC, has taught comic classes at CalArts, Otis College of Arts, and more. So to sign up, go to si-la.org, click on classes, and scroll down to find the workshop listing. Again, that's si-la.org. Also, I just want to say this is, well, very overdue, but thanks to thecoopshop.com for sending Scout a bunch of really cool stuff. You know them because they send you Walking Dead stuff for Talking Dead.
Nice.
Yeah, they're awesome. And they sent Scout and some stuff for me to give to the dogs at NKLA, t-shirts.
I've never seen Scout happier.
Toys, leashes, collars from Star Trek, Walking Dead, Adventure Time. There was a Star Trek toy she loved so much. It was like a Captain Kirk one, and it crinkled and it had squeakers, and she loved it till she killed it. But she really loved it so much.
Scout killed Kirk.
Yes, she did. But they have a lot of cool stuff for humans and for dogs and cats, and you can find them at thecoopshop.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Katie Levine. This episode is Rick Astley.
Yes.
Who was rad.
Rick came
to my house because I couldn't come into the studio. So he came to my house and we podcasted in my home. It was just like the strangest thing. Like if you ever said to me, like, one day Rick Astley is going to come to your house and you guys are going to talk for an hour. I like, what are you talking about? And he was fantastic.
So cool and normal.
So sweet.
Chill.
So normal. And really sort of embraces,
yeah,
you know, everything that's happened. And he has a new album out called 50. It's available wherever music is sold. And he's going to be touring the UK next year. Dates can be found at rickastley.co.uk. But what a great guy. I really, really, really want to see him live.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I hope he tours here.
He might. If you can keep checking his dates, I'm sure he will.
Keep checking the dates. Tell people he's out there. Tell people to get the new Rick Astley album,
yes,
so that he will come tour the United States and then we will go see him together. So here's Nerds Podcast number 832. We're literally Rick rolling you. Did we make the joke that you should say it's a different guest and then it's Rick Astley?
Oh, we should have done that.
Oh, it's too late now.
Yeah.
All right. So it'll just say, so Rick Astley will be Rick rolling himself.
Yes.
Katie, Rick roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I don't think
I think in order to be able to just purchase them without any type of a license, they have to be inoperable. They're you know, 17th and 18th century.
Like it. It's probably a good idea, to be honest. If you have a party that's happening,
I will say that big long one though. If someone broke in and I came out with that,
scare the shit out of me.
You'd feel like, okay, well, this guy's serious. I mean, that's a musket.
But having said that, he'd probably have an Uzi, wouldn't he? Or a Glock. A Glock he'd probably have. That's the gun of choice, isn't it?
As I'm packing the powder in and then, putting the ball in and stuffing it. Yeah,
exactly.
I think that process would scare someone.
Yeah.
How long are you... What brought you to Los Angeles?
I've just made a new record album. And... this is the first time I've played in America for, I think it's over 20 years.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I've been doing gigs. I retired for about 15 years.
You retired in 93?
Something like that, yeah. And then for about 10 years, I've been doing gigs in different parts of the world. And America, corny as this may sound, meant a lot to me because a lot of my favorite singers came from America. Mm-hmm. A lot of, obviously, TV shows, all that stuff. We grow up with it in Britain. We kind of... maybe not everybody does, but for me, it had a special meaning to come to America and have a hit record. It was like, that's just nuts, you know what I mean? You can do it in your own backyard, you can do it in any part of the world, but in America, it's kind of like taking sand to Arabia, do you know what I mean? It's like, you've got enough of it going on. And anyway, so we made the record. It's gone great in the UK and different parts. We've had a number one album, which for me is just bonkers. We never dreamt that would happen. It was just been one of them things where... it's, I don't know, radio really liked it. They've played the singles and it's been amazing. And then obviously America pops up. And so we've just been to New York to do a gig and then one in LA just to kind of remind people that I'm not dead, really. and then we're going to come back again hopefully in October, I think, and try and get the ball rolling properly, you know. But yeah, like I say, it's always been a place for me that I've been coming back to America. I've got a lot of friends who live here, but I haven't been here to do anything professionally or anything for years.
You know? Wow. You know, I don't think I realized how young you were when that first single hit. I mean, because I was in 87, I would have been 16. I was born in 71.
Right.
You were 66. I had no idea you were just 5 years older. You were like 20 years old.
Yeah, when I think back at certain things then, we have a daughter who's 24, and is putting a lot more perspective on it at the moment for me. Yeah. And it's kind of weird, I think. I mean, having said that, if you look at people like Bieber and you know, Britney Spears and some of those guys from that period, Justin Timberlake even, I think, a lot of those guys were super young, you know, because they came out of those the Disney Channel show and things like that. I think what's tougher now is obviously that they've got the internet,
right?
You know, it was just a CIA dream, the internet, wasn't it? when I was having my hit, so it was like I don't know really. I guess it was young, but then when I think now at some of the artists that have been massive in this last say 10, 15 years, in that pop sort of genre kind of thing, you know, 21's like an older statesman to some of those guys, isn't
it? I guess
that's Justin
true.
Bieber's probably, what is he now, 23, 24,
he's
I think?
12? No, 12. I think you're right. But you can say things to your daughter like, when I was your age, I was playing Wembley. What are you doing?
Yeah. Well, yeah, on the one hand, I can, yeah. But I also think as well, to be honest, I didn't actually do any growing up, really. I went from being a kid in bands at school and leaving school and kicking around in different, you know, the pub scene a little bit, trying to play, you know, in the little town where we're from. And then kind of sort of got a break and blah, 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 and did all of that. But I didn't really, I don't think I became an adult, if I'm honest.
Sure.
I'd even had a child and still wasn't really an adult. And I'm sure a lot of people do that anyway. But I mean, for me, it was kind of, it was a weird thing to when I stopped because I actually force myself to do things for myself as well. And maybe you've heard that from other people. I don't know. But it's like, because everything you don't do anything. You don't grow as a person either, because it's a very, on the one end, you're traveling the world and you're seeing lots of crazy things and doing lots of crazy things that people would never get the chance to do, but it's all very squashed as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So. And you're very sheltered and protected. Mm. And you also, I mean, you probably can't spend more than a day or two in a town when you're on a tour, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a bit of that thing where I think in the years since, I've done quite a bit of traveling to places that I really wanted to go to that I've probably been to maybe even a dozen times, but never seen. I've said this in an interview before where I remember, I don't know why, but I like the kind of swords and sandals things in movies. So like Gladiator and all that kind of thing, and the early ones as well. So going to Rome, I was always blown away by Rome. And I kept thinking, well, at some point we're going to go to the Colosseum and we're going to go and do da, da, da. And we just never did, because obviously they just want to just get you doing as much promo as you can. And one time I just actually said to the guy who's driving, I said, look, I don't care. You just have to pull over because I have to go and stand there for a minute, you know. And but I've been back to a lot of places like that, especially I think in Europe as well, where obviously it's a bit easier, you know. But like I said, I've been coming to America quite a lot, actually. I've got a lot of friends who live in LA and surrounding area and been here a lot, I guess, over the last 20 years or whatever.
So. Well, America's so, it's so not one thing.
Mm.
And there's actually not a lot in most of it. I mean, if you were to go across America,
yeah,
you're just there's just swaths of just not really anything.
I know exactly what you mean, because I actually drove 4 or 5 years ago. I drove from New York to LA with a director friend of mine, and basically I had an idea, and I still have this idea, and I still want to do it properly. At one point, we made like a little pilot, not even a pilot really. We just made a thing, and the idea of it was to drive to every town, or to towns, I should say, that have had a song written about them and to find out why.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So we basically went, and to be honest, there's so many great ones, but we had like a 10-day period that we could do it kind of thing, because he was doing something else anyway. I'd been in Canada to do something, so I met him in New York. We went to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, which is probably on the one, it was just part of our route. But also as a kid, I just remember that Laurel and Hardy thing and like going, do you know that song?
No, which one?
The Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
All of that, you know, and just, there's just so many. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked, but I drove across like Arkansas and places like that. Oh, yeah. And you're just kind of thinking like, wow, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Arkansas gets a bad rap sometimes, but it's a beautiful state.
Well, I'm sure it is, but I'm saying, look, when you drive through certain places and some of those towns are almost ghost towns.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's, and again, growing up as a kid, America for us, I'm sounding like an ancient or whatever, but I'm 50, but I'm, you know, but still. No, but it did have that kind of feeling of it still had that thing where you could do anything, mm-hmm, in America. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because Britain's quite a small place, isn't it? It's you know, it's got so many great things, Britain, and it's produced so many great people, I think, over, considering how small it is. But it is pretty small kind of thing. And I think when you get into certain parts of America, you realize how big it is. But it still had that thing for us because of, I think, a lot of the TV shows that we grew up with. It still had that kind of shiny kind of like anything's possible in America. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So in a way, it's even sadder to drive on one of those drives sometimes, because you do see some places that you think, wow, this is like what happened. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it just, you know, a lot of times in a lot of towns, there was something that the economy was based around, and maybe it was mining, yeah, or maybe, yeah, it was timber or something. And then the second it dries up, those towns
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's an analogous thing in Britain, but what's happened here, and I don't know if there's a name for it, but when a town starts to go under, it's like, well, they build a Home Depot and then a Walmart and then an Applebee's, and it's just like the same little commercial honeycomb repeats over and over and over again, and it feeds the town and kind of supports the town at the same time. But a lot of the mom and pop stuff is gone. Yeah. They just, you know, they disappear.
Yeah, it is. It's and I think that's world over. I've been to Australia a couple of times in this last 10 years to do gigs again. And I don't really like flying. So when I get to a place, I tend to rent a nice car or what have you. And I do the driving. I like driving. Uh-huh. Like I say, I drove across America, like I say. And there's places there where it's a bit like going back in time, because you've got that old high street thing. You wouldn't call it, you call it a main street, sorry, right. And the shops are still there, but there's hardly any of them open. Do you know what I mean? And you see that, like I say, in Australia, you'd see it anywhere. You know what I mean? It's just progress, isn't it? But I think Europe is, we've still got a bit of that individual shopkeeper thing still going. I mean, I know you have it here as well, but I mean, it's still, we've not gone completely corporate yet, I don't think.
Right.
It's definitely there. I mean, there's a Starbucks on every corner and there's a, you know what I mean? But yeah, maybe I'm being a bit naive and rose-colored spectacles, but I think, you know, if you're driving through Italy, you can still go into a local and it is just local. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there's just not a lot of places here that have any modern history more than a couple hundred years.
Sure.
And that's really quite a lot. And you really have to go to New England to find anything. It's like, well, it's from the 1600s. But a lot of the, you know, and of course, a lot of the indigenous culture was just completely wiped from the face of the map. And so, I'm always so jealous of people who can tour the UK because you could just take a train, do a show, and then come right back the next day. Yeah, America's so expansive.
No, I know. But on the one hand, surely there's two ways of looking at that. I mean, you've just said it. It's so big that you've got a lot more opportunity. I mean, even, you know, when I come to LA, I'm still amazed at how many bands play. And bands play in London, believe me, they do, but not on the same level as you have here. There's more gigs in LA, and obviously it's more, I don't know about densely populated. I don't know I don't know how many people live in greater LA or whatever, but it's
maybe like 8 million or something.
So London's that and more, I think, but obviously it's a lot more condensed and it's what have you. But I don't know, and maybe that's just seeing it as a tourist or as an outsider, but it just seems to be that if you want to go and see jazz tonight, you can go and find three places where there'll be a great jazz trio, or there might even be a big band, or there might be what have you. And I think in London that's harder to do. But again, it might be because I kind of live there, you know, on the edge of London. So maybe I don't see it the same. I just think obviously it's a much bigger place with a much larger population anyway, the States. And it's, you know.
I mean, it's kind of funny because I never go out to shows anymore. Because, you know, usually work all day, like, I don't feel like, you know, parking and then going. Yeah. But I saw Radiohead the other night and
in LA
they played the Shrine. Oh, yeah, right. And it was and I was there. I'm like, why don't I do this more often?
No.
It was, you know,
same with theater. To be honest, I mean, I think the thing with theater is with a gig, if it's not going great, you can just have another beer, right? And you can sort of say, well, whatever, and I'll wait till those songs come that I really, you know, whatever. If you go to the theater, if you don't like it, it's pretty hard to sit there
if you're not enjoying it.
Yeah. And we've walked out of things a couple of times. We go like two or three times a year. We've got some friends who they pick and pay for the tickets. We buy dinner and vice versa.
Yeah.
So they pick something, we pick something, they pick, you know, and we generally pick things that we kind of all like, you know, or in that ballpark. But, but yeah, if you go and see a stinker, it's really pretty. It's bad because you can't really stand up, can you? One of you could do it and pretend you were a bit sick, or you could go into the bathroom or doing whatever. But if four of you get up, it's like
you have to stagger it.
Okay,
I'll just we'll go out in 7 minutes.
Different directions. Yeah. Rather than just trooping out together.
Unless you're in middle seats.
Yeah. It's like a bit rough. Yeah.
Well, although I think if it's a real stinker, then everyone else is like, God damn it, we should do that.
Take the lead and then do it.
Totally do that.
Yeah.
Did you, I think the thing that's, it happened, so everything happened seemingly so fast for you.
Did
it feel that way or did it?
It didn't. I mean, the music side of it and that first hit record, Never Gonna Give You Up, definitely did. Because it you know, I was doing like radio promotion up in Scotland, I think, when I heard the first time, You're Gonna Go on Top of the Pops, which was this TV show we had on Thursday night.
Huge.
And an institution, really. And at that point I thought, okay. And then I guess like 3 or 4 weeks later we had a number one single, which is sort of on the one end the pinnacle of a pop record. It doesn't get any more than that, if you know what I mean. It's kind of like albums are different. I think rock bands are a bit different because they have the kind of live thing and it's like, do you know what I mean? It's more about the whole, you know, whereas in pop music, it's like you have a number one single and that's it, you know? And so that happened really quick. The kind of strange side to that, or the other story to that, I was signed when I was 19 to a very small production company. And the only reason I really signed to them is because I knew no better. And this guy had red leather pants. So I kind of thought, he must know something. Do you know what I mean?
Those are serious music business pants.
Exactly. So And in truth, I just thought, well, I'll just give it a go. I'll get to live in London for a few weeks. We'll do whatever. It wasn't even a record label. It was a production company. The weird thing was is that in the period from when I signed to them, literally a couple of months later, they had their first number one record with a band called Dead or Alive with a song You Spin Me Round.
Of course.
So the thing was, and they were making the whole album, and the thing was they kind of in that 6 month, eight, maybe a year period, became the biggest pop producers. They didn't do that well here, to be honest. There was only a couple of people, me included, that they actually sold records here with in the States. But they were pretty massive everywhere else. And so I kind of got pushed to the back of the line because I was signed to their production company.
Got it.
And major labels were throwing money at them to make a record for certain artists. So, and I didn't begrudge them that in any way. I know I was 19, I was 20. I wasn't in a position to say or do anything anyway. So I ended up making tea and getting the sandwiches and basically being what we used to call a tape op when we had tape machines, you know, and just helping out in the studios, which was pretty amazing because it was sort of an apprenticeship. And it was also, I got to go to the pub with the three guys because the tape ops, the juniors, were allowed to go to the pub. They can't stop them, obviously, but right. They weren't allowed to kind of sit with them. but I did. So I got an education in certain things in the business, if you know what I mean. So I still know that you can prepare yourself for having a number one record, to be honest. That's just bonkers. No, that's nuts.
I mean, it can't even seem real.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, it was weird. Yeah, it was.
I'm curious to know where that, because you mentioned Dead or Alive, and Dead or Alive, you know, I guess it's still the same now, but the 80s, you know, bands had, especially British pop bands, there was a very specific aesthetic. Like ABC had a very specific
look. Absolutely.
Depeche Mode had a very specific look. Yeah, yeah. Dead or Alive, you know, was sort of like alternative culture club, like goth culture club.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, did you look at that and go, am I supposed to have a thing or am I supposed to?
No, well, funnily enough, the weird thing is because obviously that video, Never Gonna Give You Up, has kind of taken on a whole different thing now and meaning and what have you in the past 10 years with the internet and all the rest of it. You could say that wearing a blazer and a striped t-shirt or wearing a rain mac or whatever it is or a turtleneck or what have you, I'm sure people would think, oh, wow, that stylist really knew what he was doing. They're just my clothes. You know what I mean? That was like, I just turned up. I turned up literally and it's like, well, we're making a video and this is how we're going to do it. And I just said, well, these are the clothes I brought. And they go, well, great. Here we go then. So it's like,
over there,
so there wasn't that. There definitely wasn't like an image thing. And yeah, I mean, it's funny. A lot of the bands, I guess, that I liked, some definitely did have like an image thing going on. I think the thing is, the early 80s is very much is the way you're describing it. And then I think when we went into the later 80s, it all kind of, I'm not going to say blanded out because that's not really fair, but it all got a bit safer and nicer.
Of course.
I think the early 80s were quite edgy because we'd come out of punk and we'd come out of new romantic and that whole kind of like, and also you look at someone like Boy George, no one had really done that before. Right. No one had sort of gone, I'm a man, but I'm gay. I like makeup and I'm going to wear whatever I want. Mm-hmm. No one had, they probably had actually, but I'd never, you know what I mean? Cause I was young and I probably hadn't even known that's what they were saying or doing, but I don't think they had really.
John did some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Boy George, definitely. I so remember, cause I was the perfect age for MTV. Mm. Like right when it started, just immediately it was, you know, just watching that all happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, I think because of MTV, really, the video thing became so important. So then, therefore, the image then gets magnified even more, doesn't it? It's very much about what you bring to that video. So that's why we had Simon Le Bon on the front of a yacht, you know, in pastels, doing whatever. Do you know what I mean? And that's when you think back to some of those videos, Duran Duran especially, I mean, they were one of the bands that did those mega videos, weren't they? You know, Wild Boys and stuff were
Hungry Like the Wolf. Yeah, and you referenced Rio.
I remember seeing Annie Lennox in the Eurythmics in some of those early videos and just trying to get my head around what she was saying. Not with the lyrics, but visually, the way she dressed her hair.
Right.
That kind of... you know, that she's a very beautiful woman, but she's also doing one of the videos, Sweet Dreams, I think it might be, where she's just got super cropped.
Yeah, she shaved her head. And Dave Stewart has really long, long flowing hair.
Who's the feminine one and who's the masculine? But she's so obviously very feminine as well. I'm not saying that.
Right. But they were swapping gender roles at a time when people weren't, at least... maybe underground they were, but certainly not in the mainstream media they weren't. Yeah, well, like I say,
I'm not so sure I'd ever... I mean, if you think back now and you think to certain people who act as comedians, obviously music people, whatever, and you go, well, of course they were gay. Of course they were gay. But at the time, they weren't openly gay and they wouldn't and wouldn't say so outright.
Right.
But they said everything else. Do you know what I mean?
When I think back about the Village People now, like, where was a question?
Exactly.
We didn't know?
I know. And they probably actually also said things, outright said them, but just didn't actually say, I'm gay. Do you know what I mean?
First of all, like Queen, you know, they call themselves Queen, or the Village People call themselves the Village People. You know, there were when you go back and you look at the cues, they were trying to subtly express who they were.
Exactly, yeah.
And people who knew, and people who didn't, it just didn't listen for the music.
But also, I think because, I don't know whether this is true, for me, it was like you weren't allowed to do that because big TV wouldn't have allowed you to be on the show.
Yeah, it was such a fucked up time.
Yeah.
And even thinking about George Michael having to record this kind of disclaimer at the beginning of I Want Your Sex and go, this song is not about casual sex. This is about monogamy.
Yeah.
And it's what? That's crazy that he had to, you know, just because he was writing sex on the side of some girl in lipstick.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was such a weird, innocent time.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's funny that you had mentioned some of the younger performers now. But I don't think anyone like ever heard Bad Boy Rick Astley's at it again.
No. Well, I wasn't a bad boy. I was a very good boy. But again, one of the weird things I think is that people were probably up to more hijinks and all the rest of it in the 70s and the 80s,
unquestionably,
than they are now.
Yes.
You know, I think people, you know, do the whole thing now and it's more public and it's more kind of, hey man, I am really rock and roll because I'm doing this.
Right.
But in truth and reality, I think there was a lot more stuff going on.
Some not so good stuff.
You know, and obviously you mentioned Elton John before. I mean, he's done it all, hasn't he? Do you know what I mean? In every sense of the word, in every possible everything. And, you know, I think, you know, you kind of think of some of the things that he's achieved, obviously musically, that just speaks for itself. But, you know, what he's come through, because he was in that period of total decadence and what have you. And also the thing of, you know, because he wasn't openly gay, was he? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, exactly. It wasn't, you know. And, yeah, it's funny. I've sung at a couple of gay pride things. I've done the one in Madrid and what have you, which is massive. It's crazy, actually. And it seems weird sometimes that you had to have a day to celebrate that and to sort of be proud of it, if you know what I mean. Because you kind of think, well... Is it not? Because at this day and age, you kind of think, well, isn't that just absolutely every day?
Yeah.
But I get it, and you know, and it was a fun thing to do, to be honest. But yeah, it is kind of weird that that's almost even up for question.
Well, it's almost like I think some of those two are almost can be kind of perceived as sort of a day of remembrance too. Essentially like the same as an Independence Day.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. When you see it like that, then I guess that's very true. Yeah.
Especially now, you know, I think before it was more declarative and now it's more, I assume, at least from what I've talked to you know, friends who are in the gay community, that there's that sense of like, it's like an Independence Day where you know, you sort of celebrate and remember and never forget, you know.
Yeah.
But
That it wasn't like this.
But it's such a. I mean, it is. I mean, I old man talk at people all the time. In the 80s were just such a strange. Mm. I don't know. It was like we had blinders on or something. We had these willful blinders on. And,
well, we didn't have the internet, I really think that is. I think that's a. It's. I can't understand how people are going to grow up and not have it and not know what it's like not to have it.
Right.
And I am sounding old now, and that's okay.
Oh yeah, your daughter wouldn't really know what it's like to not have it.
No, and I think it's actually destroyed certain things, and some of that's okay, some of it's not, and it's also given us so much as well. But in terms of naivety and what have you, you know, young kids. Well, I say young kids. Friends of ours, their son, who is 27, I think, now. And he's a musician and a producer and what have you. And he's almost like freaked out now. He said, because kids, as he calls them, he's 27, kids, he said, they just know everything. He said, they know every genre of music. They know everything. You can't tell them anything at all. Because, and he's DJed a lot as well, he said, because they just know everything about music. You know, they know everything.
I think a lot of people, I think there's a thing that's happening where people just think they know everything.
Yeah, maybe.
Because they know a little bit, you know, I think the internet gives us a very shallow take on a wide berth of things. And so it's like they might know a couple things, but then just act like, oh, yeah, no, I know all about this.
Yeah.
When we were kids,
yeah.
if you wanted to be into a certain type of music, you had to find a record shop, order it, you know.
Yeah.
Even I always make the comparison with British television, which I loved when I was a kid, and it was very difficult to come by here.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's just, everyone's just spoiled now because you can have everything.
Well, I think always. That's it. It does feel a bit spoiled in a way. It's like you get on a long distance flight now and you get on and you go, what, they've only got 150 movies? Oh my God. And, you know, and I can be on the internet at the same time. I did a flight actually from, I think it was to LA. It was on a Qantas. And they did this thing. I thought it was genius. They had a, what do you call it? Movie awards. The Oscars. They had an Oscar channel. And it was every Oscar movie from year one, I think.
Great.
It was amazing. And because it's a long flight. I don't know what it is, 12, 15 hours, something stupid. And I remember getting on there just thinking, I'd had food poison as well, so I wasn't in a great state. So I'll get on there and I'm just thinking, and you know, because I love movies. I really, really like, my wife works in movies and we both do. Really, really, I can watch three films one after the other. No problem. I can do that. You know what I mean? Bowl of pasta in between and just do it. And I remember getting on there and just sort of thinking, oh, what the hell am I going to? Because it's usually you've seen all the ones you wanted to see anyway kind of thing. And, you know, and I just thought that is just a genius idea. Genius. I'm trying to think what I watched now. I think I watched Gladiator again, I think. I can't remember. But there's some just amazing movies on there. Really, because there would be, obviously, you know.
Well, it's, yeah, and we're about to do, we're going to Japan for the honeymoon.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm, you know, on some flights over the ocean, we'll have internet and some won't.
Okay.
And I'm already completely spoiled. Like, what am I going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
That whole, you know, it's like.
You just got married, man. What are you going to do? You're going to smooch. You're going to kiss and canoodle.
Oh, yeah. Canoodling. Legal canoodling.
Have you been to Japan before then?
I've never been.
Oh, right. Okay. So why Japan then? What?
Because I always wanted to go.
Right.
And she's been there for work for a minute, but didn't really leave her, you know, wherever she was working in Tokyo.
Right.
And it just kind of seemed like, because I never, you need a couple weeks to go, and I never get that much time off.
Right.
And so I was allowed to pre-shoot some things because of the honeymoon.
Got it.
So it was the perfect excuse. Like, if we don't go now, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Are you going to do? Are you going to go to Kyoto as well?
Yes.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Because the first time I actually sang my old songs again after all those years of not doing it, was I had an offer to go to Japan. And I'd been a few times, obviously, back in the day. But my wife had never been and our daughter had never been. Our daughter was probably about 14, 15 then. And they kind of, you know, their ears pricked up and said, you've had enough to go where? And I always just said flat no to all of it. I just said, you know, I said, I'm done with it. I'm not doing that again kind of thing. And basically they kind of forced me to go. And and it was really great to go because I liked it anyway. It's an amazing place. But to go again, because we had obviously I did the gigs, but we had a family thing there. It's just amazing. It's just such a...
Why did you think you never wanted to do that again?
I think because when I quit, I think in pop music especially, I think, you know, if you were a rock band or something or what have you, I think you could do it again, light that fire and do it. But I think in pop music, it just felt a bit kind of, well, that's done. That was then. That's it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think nostalgia has become enormous. You know, I mean, this... I'm just trying to think who I just saw recently. Thompson Twins. I saw Tom Bailey recently, and he's playing in LA Human League are going to be here. I mean, I play with those guys all the time. I mean, different parts of the, you know, you just end up on a bill somewhere.
Sure.
In a field in front of a few, whatever, 1,000 people or whatever it is. And they're like festivals, but retro festivals, if you know right. what I mean. And obviously I do my own gigs as well, you know, but I'm saying, you know, I meet a lot of those guys and stuff. And I just kind of felt, I didn't really want to do it really. I just felt it was a bit odd to go back and do that. And I think actually having enough distance from it and also getting older, it just felt okay. And also I think going to Japan was a perfect way to start again because it was so unusual to go there. It's such an unusual place.
I can't that wait.
It just, yeah, no, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And I actually don't think it will disappoint in any way because it is properly different.
Did it feel good to play the stuff again? Or did it feel like, this old stuff?
It felt really good. It felt weird. It felt like a giant... I actually said, welcome to the biggest karaoke in Tokyo when we went out and sat and did the tunes. And... It was a bit weird, but it was also deja vu as well. As we all experience in life, things sometimes feel like yesterday, and then other times they feel like someone else's life, and it's like you've just stepped into shoes that don't belong to you anymore. Do you know what I mean? It was weird, and it still is to this day. Singing some of those old songs sometimes, it's weird. And then I look at the audience, I think, yeah, you're as old as I am. You know, and then that brings you in and you go, yeah, well, and I don't know. I think I would have poo-pooed the whole nostalgia thing at some point in my life. But at some point you get to a point in, and you can actually say, when people used to say, oh, you know, we got married, that song was our wedding song, da da da. I was 24, so I'd go, great.
Right.
I wouldn't connect with that, you know what I mean? I've been with my wife now for 27 years. We have a 24-year-old daughter. Da, da, da. I've lived, you know what I mean? And therefore, I understand, because we've got our song. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when we go and see Crowded House, you know.
What's your Crowded House song?
It's Don't Dream It's Over.
One of the best songs. That Neil Finn, he is a
monster.
He is a monster.
He is, yeah. And I think I understand it. I totally understand why those memories are so locked into music or movies and different things, maybe even books for some people, I don't know. And in a way, I've come round to the thing to appreciate that it was only pop music, a bit cheesy at times even possibly, but I don't actually think the songs are completely cheesy. I think the videos are a bit cheesy sometimes. when I go back to them, I think the songs kind of, in their own way, stand up to... you know, scrutinization, for, especially with what was around as well. You know what I mean? And
yeah, but every generation, you know, every generation looks back and goes, "Nah, that old stuff is all cheesy." You know, it's like they all do it.
Well, they do, but I think certain genres of music, if you look at rock, for instance, proper just rock is rock.
Right.
It's only because we went into that kind of spandex rock that when you look back at that and the hair. Yeah. I mean, they've always had the long hair. You know what I mean? But they just bouffonted it. That was MTV
yeah. influence.
Yeah, and you kind of look at some of those and you kind of think, wow, you know, maybe that was okay. You could have left that particular,
but if you don't have that, you don't have the rebellion of grunge.
Exactly.
Of the, you know, it's like each decade has to deconstruct the previous decade. But I think it's really, I don't know, I think it's really nice because I think it, when you're young and you do something, I think you can have an ego where you're like, well, I don't want to be defined by that thing. But then I think when you get older, you're like, you know, it's fun. Who gives a shit? I don't have to impress anyone anymore. I just have to have fun.
Yeah. And I think I didn't really have hang-ups about it. That wasn't why I quit, really. It was just I just had enough of it all, really. And I'd become a dad, you know, and it was kind of like – I'm truly not – I'll just say it. I made a lot of money.
Sure.
Not like, you know, Madonna money, but I mean, I made a lot of money. And
you were in the business at the right time. You caught the end of the best time.
We sold a lot of physical units.
40 million or some crazy number.
Some crazy amount, yeah. And so I think what that also made me do was think, well, you should only do it then if you actually want to do it. Because money, I think at some point, if you're lucky enough, once you've got past the point of having to worry about it, well, actually, the strangest thing is that when people become really, really, really rich, then they start to worry about the money then, don't they? They go the other side of it, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But I think if you can get in that comfort zone where money's not a problem,
right,
then I think that also helps you sort of, you know, you're one of the lucky ones. You can choose not to do shit.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of it for me. I just kind of said, you know, I'm comfortable. I don't have to do it. And I didn't do it for the money. Obviously, I don't think many people do. You do it because it's you're a kid in a band, and then you get a record deal, and then all of a sudden you make a load of money if you're lucky. And obviously, I know fame and fortune go together and all that, but I don't think anybody actually gets in a band at school just for money. Do you know what I mean?
I think in the MTV generation, though, I think in my generation they saw it. Yeah. And they were like, oh, I want that. I want that. Yeah. I want that Van Halen lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And listen, But I think some people do for sure, yeah. But I think money's a weird one. But I'm totally fine about talking about it. Because one thing that really bores me is when people say in a way, oh, I'm not bothered about the money. I was never bothered about the money. The reason that someone can say that is because they've got the freaking money.
Right.
And that's why I'm never embarrassed or ashamed to say I made a lot of money.
Because, of course.
Because I did, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's that changes your whole life, for one. But it also, for me, changes your emotion and thinking about a lot of other things in life because they're not a struggle anymore. And you can make choices based on what you really actually want rather than, you know.
What's crazy is some people still don't do that, though, because I think they do. It's, you know, it can be all about the pursuit of the money or pursuit of attention or whatever it is. Mm. But I think it, you know, it's not till a lot later in life that I think people go, well, what's going to make me happy? Like, yeah, I think people focus on external things to try to make them happy as opposed to just being happy.
Totally. Well, my mom and dad divorced when I was very young, and it was just a bit of an odd time growing up. And we grew up with my dad, and I saw my mom all the time. She lived in the same little town as us. But I think, obviously, you know, like a lot of people, certain things in your childhood leave a hole somewhere or leave a scar or whatever, analogy you want to use. And I definitely think that most people, I'd say everybody, to be honest, but I mean, I can't say that because it's not for me to say, people who get on a stage, it's not just for the love of what they're doing.
Right.
There's something else in their makeup, chemistry, life, whatever, of what they're trying to achieve from that.
Sure.
And I'm not saying I consciously thought being in front of hundreds or thousands of people singing along or screaming my name or da-da-da-da was going to make me feel better, but I kind of thought it was, I think, somewhere. And I think at some point you just realize, well, that isn't going to do it. It's the boring old cliche, but you do have to find it somewhere else. You've got to find it either within or, you know, with real people around you, whatever, you know, you're not going to find it in the back of a limo or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That ain't going to happen. And, but if I'm thinking about it, I think there's still a tiny part of me that thinks it is. Do you know what I mean? And you have to just remind yourself, no, it ain't.
It isn't.
Yeah. Cause it's addictive, isn't it? You get on a stage and if there's people and you're happening and it's happening, it's all going, that's really addictive.
Of course it is.
Chemically inside you, things go on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've never done drugs, really. I'm not really a drug, you know, whatever, just because I just wasn't. But I can imagine it must be really, really difficult not to do drugs once you've done it, because it's like I've experienced my own drug, if you like, of being on a stage and adrenaline going through the roof and kind of like, wow, you know, this is so, yeah.
Well, I think our brains do constantly try to find things that sort of spike the endorphins. Mm. And I mean, we are just drawn to that. Yeah, and it can be, you know, it can be that, or it could just be literal drugs, or it could be collecting something, or it can be traveling. Yeah. Or, you know, it's like we're always just trying to fight that. We're always just trying to find that thing that makes us spike a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty interesting that first of all, I feel like I need marriage advice for someone who's been married for 27 years.
Well, we've actually only been married for 3.
Okay, but you've been
together for 27. Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah. But we met because my wife worked at the record label in Denmark, where she's from. So she kind of did the marketing and the promo and everything when I went up there the first time. And then we met a few years later, and then we kind of got together. And then she kind of quit working in the music business. And she's been working in film since then. So, but I think we've got a good understanding of what it takes to do what we both do, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And she actually manages me now, as done for a couple of years. Yeah. And which is, you know, that's she's done an absolutely amazing job, because she's given a 50-year-old guy a number one album in the UK. Boom, boom. I think it is difficult at times, because it's we're married and we have to respect that, and we've got to make time for that. You know what I mean? And I think in businesses like this and these situations, you kind of, you're just full on, really. And it's really hard sometimes to just have those moments of coziness, because she'll say, oh, by the way, we've just had this email about this. Or, do you know what I mean? Because it's hard not to, because we're both really excited about it as well. And when she's been, you know, producing a film or doing what have you, it's like, it gets a bit full on, you know what I mean? And sure. It's like, it's just, but I think there's respect there. And I think that's, you know, for what we do work-wise. And I think therefore, and just respect for the passion we've both got in both what we do and stuff. And I think that's been a massive part of being able to stay together, to be honest.
Yeah. I've been reading, and it's not because I think, oh, I'm going to fuck this up. Although sometimes I think, like, oh, I'm going to fuck this up. But, you know, from what I've learned and from what I've asked people and heard, you know, maintaining a level of respect and then kindness, like just remembering to be kind to each other and not just make someone the repository for all of your shit is very helpful in maintaining a good relationship.
And again, and any managers out there who are listening to this will wholeheartedly agree with this, I think. Artists or assholes, whichever way you want to.
I mean, it can be a little
They give their managers shit a lot of the time. I hopefully don't do that with Lena. I hope I don't.
I think she'd let you know.
Yeah, she would. She would. It's just difficult, is all I'm saying. But it's also been amazing as well, because on some of the trips that haven't involved, you know, where it's kind of all the work's been done, you just got to go and do it, as it were. Like we went to Chile this year and we had a few weeks there, and it was just amazing. It was just really, because it's great. I've been before and it's a beautiful country. And we were out on the coast as well as being in Santiago as well. And you just, many times I'll stick something on Facebook or what have you saying thank you to everybody, because, and my wife, she doesn't like to be in photographs, to be honest. So she doesn't do it, but, we both mean it, because we're kind of in a time of our lives when we're still getting to do really, really fun things, based around something that we're both passionate about. And that's, not everyone gets that, you know what I mean?
That's pretty amazing.
And we are aware of it, is what I'm saying. I make sure we're aware of it, and so does she, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, you say when you look in the audience, you see people, older people out there, but I feel like a lot of young people, I mean, who could have predicted the internet thing and becoming probably one of the most popular memes on all of the internet?
It's weird.
Yeah, it's weird.
It is. But I mean, it's
talk about, you thought you were done with that, and you're like, like, you're not done.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is weird. Yeah, and it's obviously been very good for me, because it's brought an audience, if you like, or not even an audience, just an age group of people who would know that song or know who I am or da da da. And I don't know whether that's actually helped with, let's say, for instance, this new record that I've made. I can't tell you that, but there's a part of me that thinks it has, because when I sometimes read through the comments on, you know, something I've posted or what have you, I can see the age group of people, and I'm kind of thinking, and also we have like a really, of course we would do, but we have a really good digital team who handle all my whatever, you know what I mean? Because I'm old and I don't understand that shit.
I mean, you say, we're not...
No, I'm not
40s
old,
and but 50s, but to our parents were kind of getting old at that age.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think when I think back to being 21, when, you know, all that happened for
50
me...
50 sounded like a fucking agent.
Exactly. It's like, what? You know what I mean? That was an age that you just thought, how does anyone ever get to be 50? You know what I mean?
Right.
And now I am. So, no, I'm kind of joking with it. And to be honest, a lot of my friends who are my age or even a bit older are doing stuff that, like, you know, I wouldn't have dreamt we'd be doing. You know what I mean? Me included. I having a record out again. Do you know what I mean? I didn't dream I'd be doing that, really. So I always thought it was a possibility, because, you know, anything's almost possible in life. But yeah, age is a weird thing. I don't think age isn't what it used to be. I don't think.
No,
it's just.
And
not.
I think the sort of the idea of it's kind of similar to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, putting people in boxes and being who you are, and, you know, I think coming out of the post-war era, it was like, okay, you got to get a job and you got to work that job because you got to support your family. You got to rebuild our economy. We got to rebuild the culture. Yeah. It's responsibility, responsibility. They just had to get older faster to because of responsibility, and we didn't have to. And this generation really fucking doesn't have to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but you look great. I mean, like, look at that thick, lustrous head of hair. Hey. No one would even, you still... You know, you still look the same, which is nice.
I look quite the same, but I've got my hair, which is great. I'm really happy about that. My whole family, all the guys in the family have still got pretty good hair, whatever age they get to be honest. So,
nice.
So that's quite lucky, yeah. Yeah. No, it's I'm having a good time at the moment. It's good.
Was recording the album a completely different experience time around?
Totally. We moved house about 3 years ago, I think I said. And I converted this garage building or garage building at the back of the house and put a little studio in there, and that's where I made the record, and I played all the instruments on it. I did everything. So the only bit I didn't do is the female backing vocals, because I haven't quite worked out how to do that.
you have two buttery bassy of a voice.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we've always got auto tune, you know, stick it up an octave. But I did it all. A really good friend of mine mixed it and engineered and stuff like that, and we did the vocals together, obviously, because, you know, it's nice to have someone to kind of bounce off, if you know what I mean.
That just sounds fun. Like, it just sounds like, even if you hadn't ever put it out, it just sounds like, yeah, it was a fun thing to do.
Well, to be honest, I'm trying to remember exactly how I did start the process. I know I bought some new gear, and as I say, we were fixing the house up, so I put this room together, and then... And I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I've always been saying I'm going to make a new record at some point. Whether I'm actually going to play it to anybody is a different matter. And then I don't know. I just got into it, and I just really started to feel it. And I think some of the lyrics on this record are really personal as well. And I think I'm in a place where I'm happy to do that. And so it's just been a really good process. And I think something in it. I'm a real big believer. I've heard this from many different producers and writers and all the rest of it, is that you have to, there's something that happens in the recording process that you can't make happen. It just happens. And something then therefore connects with a certain audience. And if you, because if producers knew what it was, they'd do it every week.
Of course.
So I'm sure that's the same with any creative endeavor, really. But I think in the studio, you know, because you've got all the gear and you've got all the lights and all the everything and the, you know, and you think, well, we'll just do the record like we did that other one. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't work like that. And so whatever's happened for us, you know, back home, it's kind of just clicked and it's worked, you know. So whether that'll happen anywhere else, who knows? But I sort of hoped and like to think that it's because I did it purely from a state of loving it and wanting to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a record deal or anything. I just did some tracks. We got like 4 or 5, 6 finished. And then I went and played it to someone. So I just felt that was just the best way of doing it. Rather than being like the old dude who's on a record label, who, and then a party of 12 people sit around a big table and say, what are we going to do with that old guy?
Right.
Because we need to do something with him. I just wanted to be where they heard something and thought, okay, that's pretty good. Let's have a go at it.
Yeah, you didn't need to do it. You just wanted to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the best. Are you going to do it again, or do you feel like, maybe I'll hang it up again?
I don't know. And to be honest, it was a lot of work, and I really loved it, but it was very time-consuming. And I loved, you know, I'm not really a musician, really. I can play a bit of everything, and I'm all right, but I'm not, you know, I've got a really great band, and I just fell into doing it. I liked the demo sort of things, and then the demos became the tracks, and then the tracks became the record. Blah, blah, blah. And so I think if I was to do another one, I quite like the idea of working with a producer who sort of comes to me and says, well, I've always wanted to make a record like this. What do you think? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like saying like someone like a Mark Ronson, for instance, all right, maybe he's like, you know, the name everyone would say, but he tends to do things that are very stylized and very kind of like maybe I'm completely wrong here, but almost like he's dreamt that up first and said, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
And I think that's probably because he's a DJ as well. And he's got that wealth of real knowledge about music. Do you know what I mean? And I think, and if you go to, let's say the Amy Winehouse record or something like that, it was very, very modern and very now, but also unbelievably kind of retro and authentically that sort of influence that, you know. And I think someone like him is really great at doing that thing of taking something that maybe we think we all know and then kind of just tweaking it and turning it into something else, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it just even... Johnny Cash did an amazing album, like, right before he died.
Yeah.
And some of the most...
You're saying I'm right before I'm going to die right now, or what?
You went, no! No, he did, I just mean...
No, I know.
If, you know, in 30 years, you could still, if you got inspired to do something, you could...
No, in 30 years, I know what I'm doing. If I'm still here in 30 years, my wife and I are having a beach restaurant in Italy, and I am going to croon with a nice little jazz trio... But only when I want. And it will be fueled by really good Italian red wine.
Yeah. And people will come like, I don't know. Sometimes he comes out. Sometimes he doesn't. You just don't know if he's going, oh, there he is. Oh, he doesn't feel like it
tonight. And it will usually depend on what color velvet jacket I'm wearing as well. Because I'll have seven. So there'll be one for each night, you know. And she will just float around as like the maitre d' and kind of like, you know.
Did you have to warm up your voice at all through a process? If you weren't really using it for like 15 years?
No, well, I was floating around and I had a little studio and different things. And I did some projects and did some little things. I've done a bit of film music as well. And I mean a little bit of film music. And I also have a band, a trio, where I play drums and sing. And it's a power trio. It's a rock trio.
Nice.
Where we play from like the Pistols to the Foo Fighters. And we're like middle-aged men, obviously, but because we do it for charity, it's okay.
Yeah,
it's fine.
It's totally fine. Yeah. No one's gonna say like, "What are you doing?"
You're
like,
exactly.
Hey, I'm here for the kids. What are you doing?
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah,
that's genius.
So I have been singing here and there. I mean, on the subject of warming up, I do that a lot. I do that kind of religiously now when I do gigs and stuff. I've just worked with a couple of people who have taught me a few things. And also I've had a few, not personally, but you have a few scary moments where you hear somebody, you think, well, they're always going to have that voice.
Right.
And then you hear that they have problems and you think, well, why, you know, because then as a singer, you start thinking, how did that happen? You know?
Right.
And it's the obvious ones. It's, I don't smoke, but I do like a drink.
Yeah.
And, I had a few drinks last night and I can hear that in my voice right now, to be honest. And it's just being like, realistic. If you were an athlete or what have you, then you have to prepare, don't you? Do you know?
Oh,
what
yeah,
mean?
It's a muscle. And, yeah. But it's also why, you know, when people were doing all that crazy shit in the 70s that you were talking about earlier, I was like, yeah, a lot of them, they didn't really come out of that well.
No. I was really lucky. Like I said, I didn't really ever get into drugs. I've got more and more into wine as I've got older. but I've never really...
And your voice started out kind of bassy.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you had this boyish face and that bassy, like, really intense. It's not like you had a real high voice that's dropping.
No. And I think that was part of the charm, if you want to call it that, is that I looked 11 and sounded completely different. And it was, I even remember that the three guys, the producers who wrote that tune and produced it, Never Gonna Give You Up, we didn't actually release it for a long time after they'd done it. And I think because they were having like internal battles about is it the right thing, are people going to get this? Literally, because I did look like, you know, I was still in school, and but I sounded completely different, you know. And I think, to be honest, I think that was part of it, you know. It was kind of like a lot of people even thought I was black, which I'd never quite understood. I mean, a lot of my favorite singers, you know, Luther Vandross, and even going back to old school soul and what have you been, I've been very influenced by, for sure. But I never really heard that. Really.
Well, I'm just sort of remembering that moment of people hearing the song on the radio and seeing the video and be like, that guy looks like that. You know, it's just like, not. Yeah. It was very unexpected.
Yeah. And I think that was part of it, really. So,
Well, I hope you enjoy your time in Los Angeles, and I hope when are you going back home? Are you going back home, or are you?
No, we are. We go back on Tuesday, I think it is. Yeah, we're actually making a video here on Monday for a tune.
Great.
Yeah, so that's going to be fun. And this weekend we're going to hang out with friends up in Topanga.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you have a good
a good sense of humor about the whole thing. I mean, just like how weird the internet thing is.
Yeah. I mean,
and just the concept of like Rickrolling is a verb. Your name is now a verb. It's an internet thing. And you always seem to kind of have a good...
Yeah, well, because I think I was lucky that my daughter was a teenager at the time when that kicked off. She was 15 or something like that. And we had quite a few conversations about it. And it actually helped because obviously she's of the generation, as we said before, that grew up just with the internet just being there and being a totally normal thing. So on the one end, it was weird because it's her dad.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's just like, oh, it's just another one of those things. and so she kind of taught me, if you like, or you know, turned on the light that just sort of said, yeah, she's right. It's just another one of them things. It's got nothing to do with me, really. It's just they chose that video, and it could have been Dave Roll or Brian Roll or Mary Roll or anything.
Anything, yeah.
It just happened to be, you know. And I think I've learned, as I have anyway, even if that wouldn't have happened, I've learned to appreciate those songs because of what they've done for me. And also because in a tiny, tiny little way of the rich tapestry of music or of life, I've got my tiny little window that people have and they open up and there I am, you know. And that's kind of nice. That's something to appreciate rather than be embarrassed of or you know, whatever. So,
well, that's fantastic. Well, I thank you so much for
pleasure.
Thanks for coming to my house.
Thank you.
We're just
I'm loving your house.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. We're just in the midst of eight days from the wedding. Family's starting to come in.
It's cool.
I'm not nervous, but it's just that stress of like, oh, everyone's coming in. It just feels like a massive holiday.
Have you got your speech prepared?
Yeah, I've been making notes the last couple weeks, and so it's, yeah, it's not...
You don't sound convincing, to be honest, right now.
Well, for better or for worse, I'm a comedian, and so the way that I will write it is just, I'll write it by... Not, I mean, there'll be punchlines, but there'll be emotional stuff too. So I've just been writing the beats of like, oh, this is a funny thing to talk about, or I should mention this, and this is a special thing that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So it has an arc to it, but it's just, I'm not going to write it verbatim.
Right.
Because I just don't.
No,
I don't.
You don't do that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that, but her mom has a great sense of humor and my mom has a great sense of humor. So I don't think I'm going to offend anyone.
Okay.
But we're not doing any. No one else is allowed to do a toast. That I cut that shit right off.
Oh really?
All my friends are comics. I don't want them getting drunk and saying crazy shit. You know,
like they're going to do that anyway.
I know, but I don't want to. I want
you
it
to give
be
them a
sanctioned.
License too. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
I don't want to give them. You don't want to give a drunk comedian a microphone and be like, go ahead, and then you know.
Yeah, that's probably a scary prospect, isn't it, really? Yeah.
So we decided to kill that part. It was my...
It's going to happen anyway. I'm sorry, that is going to happen.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Someone's going to jump up on stage and be like, I know I'm not supposed to say anything.
But...
you know, but cool. Whatever. It'll be nice. But I thank you so much for coming here. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting.
Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.